Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 196 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling, So How'd We Do? U.S. Wheat's Vince Peterson assesses trade agreements, wheat exports, prices, COVID-19, virtual meetings, and more, too. Before I get to this week's episode, I'd like to encourage you again to listen to the bonus episode I posted on the Washington Grain Commission website at wagrains.org. It's episode 123, entitled LOMO, the Apollo 11 of Snake River Dams. In other words, Lower Monumental is 50. We'll make that 51 years old this year, and it takes a lot of maintenance to keep it in tip-top condition. As many farmers who depend on the river to move their grain know, a snapped cable holding a guide wall in place at the dam has cut hours during the busiest time of the year. Give it a listen. One of the worst things a reporter can do, at least when I was a reporter, is to bury the lead, meaning to place the most important information in a story several paragraphs below the first sentence. I want you to know up front that I have buried the lead of this episode, which involves a long question I asked Vince Peterson, the president of U.S. Wheat Associates, at the very end of our interview. The question is about the importance of wheat quality and asks why other states haven't taken the same steps we have in the Pacific Northwest. Peterson doesn't dodge the question, but he does explain the forces that are acting upon the question, which helped me understand why the Pacific Northwest has been more successful in wrestling with the issue of quality than any other section of the country. On the other hand, there's no explanation for why some see the writing on the wall and act, while others don't. This episode begins where Peterson and I left off talking about trade, specifically the hurt feelings that abounded among customers south of the border as a result of USMCA treaty negotiations. In my previous podcast with Peterson, he said he was going on an apology tour once the USMCA deal was final. I asked him about the bruised feelings in Mexico and if the relationship had been healed in the interim.
When we spoke about that the last time, we definitely were not healed. In fact, we had a circumstance where, you know, some of our very good Mexican friends almost didn't even want to travel to the United States because they were so personally upset about some of the things that the president had said, but also the way, frankly, I have to give some criticism, some ways that the media portrayed those comments made it probably double as bad as what he said in the first place. But we had a big conference last summer, early June. We called it our apology tour conference, and had all of the core Mexican industry there. And it was probably the best setting for camaraderie and friendship and commercial closeness and relationships of anything that I've sat through in my 35 years with U.S. Wheat. And so going into that and now back, we've really turned the corner out. I think that's all healed, and I just think it's all forward looking from here on out. So we're really in very good shape down there.
Wonderful, wonderful.
So Vince, wasn't there a deal with Brazil in there too? It didn't get a lot of publicity, but as I recall, it was good news for wheat.
Yeah, there was, and that was a little bit different in that it wasn't technically a U.S.-Brazil bilateral deal, but like the China, we talked about the TRQ, tariff rate quota opening for China. Brazil had a tariff rate quota that was for all non-Mercosur wheat suppliers, so that's, you know, the U.S., Canada, which were typically the two that supplied most. Now Russia sort of entered the equation and some others, But Brazil never implemented that all the way back to the GATT agreement in 1995. And we found that about a dozen years ago. And for 12 years, we've been pushing and pushing and pushing to get that on the table and opened up. Well, this whole trade thing and the new presidents, Bolsonaro and Brazil and Trump, were sort of simpatico politically and personality-wise and stuff. And so they got together, and in their first meeting, that was the one issue that they sat together and agreed to solve. Because it was something the two presidents, it was kind of an easy, sort of a no-brainer. Brazil had already agreed to do it 20 years ago. They just never implemented it. So fast forward, that has been done. It's been implemented in Brazil. It's a 750,000-ton duty-free import quota. Again, it's open to all non-Mercosur countries, but it opens up that much quantity every single year to U.S. wheat. And over the course of time, U.S. has done about 80% of the non-Mercosur wheat imports into Brazil. So we think we're in a really good place. We're off to a good start down there. I think we're already in that right now, just in the first month and a half of the marketing year. We're about 150,000 tons ahead of where we were last year with Brazil. It looks like the August, September, October portion, and this is mostly all hard red winter wheat, mostly for Brazil. There's probably an 800,000 ton pool of demand right there that we think we have a very good chance to get. In fact, I think next week you're going to see two or three cargoes that registered for export to Brazil. So, but we've got competition. The Russians are very cheap this year. Their FOB prices are $20 or $25 cheaper than our hard red winter wheat, and there has been probably 200,000 tons of Russian wheat that's been sold into Brazil as well. So there's competition for it, but it's opened that market up a little bit farther for us. It's a good market for us. We've got long term history there, and it's working. So that was a really a good one.
All right. Vince, the USDA estimates next year's average wheat price at $4.60 a bushel. Now, that's just 2 cents more than the average price this year. I got to say, for all the effort on trade issues, that doesn't sound like much of a price bump. Or am I being too short-sighted?
No, you can't be short-sighted when you're looking at the average price bump. It is what it is. But I think, in one of your other comments, you had made some allusion. Is there something going on out there, or is it kind of basically simple economics that we're dealing with? And the bottom line, it sort of tails in what some of the comments I made earlier. When you look at where we are overall in the grand scheme of things in the world marketplace, what happens in the United States is quite important, but it doesn't always necessarily translate into what the wheat price dynamic is for the world. So, when you look at the bottom line of these things, if you look back over the last 10 or 11 years, something like that, world consumption of wheat has gone up 100 million tons. And you think, wow, that's absolutely unbelievably huge. 100 million ton increase in wheat consumption just in the last 11 years. So that was a new record. It's up over 750 million tons now. That's probably going to be a billion tons by the time we get out to about 2045 or something, another 25 years from now. But at the same time, in these last 11 years, we've had 7 new record world productions at the same time. So, and at the moment, we're still producing a total of 20 million tons a year right now, more wheat than we're consuming in the world, even at these higher record paces. So it's that part is really basic math. When we continue to outproduce the demand, yeah, the world market continues to sag somewhat. So I think our prices aren't improving. They're certainly not improving in Europe. They're not improving in Russia. They're not improving anywhere because of this total supply that's just exceeding demand right now. So our task is still to try to carve out individual places, try to price our wheat into the best markets possible to get the best return that we can out of that marketplace in a world that has more wheat than it needs on a year-to-year basis.
Okay. All right. Vince, you received a chunk of money, more than $8 million, as part of the Trump-inspired agricultural trade promotion program. Can you update me on what that money has been used for at U.S. Wheat?
Yeah, I sure can. That was a really big help for us and other commodity groups that were able to take some advantage of this program. To put that in context, just so listeners know, U.S. Wheat has contracts with USDA every year for several different programs, and some of them go back, decades in age. We contract for about $12 million a year, something of that nature of USDA, what's called foreign market development and market access funds on a normal basis. It's a competitive process, but that's we normally compete in about that range. So this $8 million is actually part of what was, it became a 5-year program to try to help recover from the lack of China sales and go forward. So USWE was able to take and execute new activities that we simply didn't have the funding to do under the other programs. And that runs the gamut, Scott. I mean, it runs the gamuts from, you know, teams we bring to the States to technical and marketing programs we do overseas, to in-country seminars, to a whole bunch of things that we just didn't have the resources to do and the outreach to do in order to try to stimulate our position there. But then I have to say, all of a sudden you hit the brakes here this year. That program was just barely getting going when this virus thing hit. And so this year that we're in right now is the first year, really the first fiscal year of that ATP program. And we had programmed all of these activities, and every single activity from March literally to the end of the year has to be canceled and redone in some way or another. So, you know, if the question were, what are we doing with it today? We are reformulating every one of those things into some kind of a virtual activity, or putting that money into some other program that can be done on a virtual remote, mostly in a virtual remote basis. And that's literally everything we do, from crop quality seminars, where normally we send teams overseas every year, travel around country to country and present the new crop quality information. All that's going to be done in a virtual environment. We've been doing seminars with buyers. We just did one last night with over 200 industry members from Japan's government, milling sector, baking sector, food processing, and did a whole hour and a half on U.S. market circumstances, crop outlooks, those kind of things. So the money is having to be completely redone. It's going into you know, platforms and software and development of programs, video things, products that we can use in a way that we were never able to use them before. We're having states like Washington Wheat Commission or others that are producing material in their own states that we can virtually do a trade team visit to Washington State or Oregon without anyone ever setting foot there. But there's so much material being produced that we can replicate that almost without anyone getting on an airplane. So we'd like to think this is going to change sometime soon, but the reality of this seems like it's going on and on and on. And if we judge that by the reaction of the Japanese last night, they just assumed that we're not going to get together face-to-face perhaps for this year. And that's a really terrible thing to think about, but it really taps our creativity to come up with ways to take the money that we do have, this ATP funds, and translate that into a different way of doing business. One of the things that we're very grateful for is USDA and contracting with groups like ours for these funds realizes that you cannot spend the same kind of money doing it this way as if you're traveling overseas, if you're employing people to do all these things. So they are allowing us to roll this funding forward. So when we get to the ends of our fiscal years, we'll make an accounting, and whatever money is unspent from these programs doesn't disappear as it would in a normal budget fiscal year. It will be rolled over to the next year and hopefully the year after that. So we'll have an opportunity to catch up to where we can get back to business as normal, get boots on the ground in all of these countries like we normally do, and catch up a little bit with it in that way.
You know, Vince, I have been seeing comments from participants in some of these virtual meetings, and, you know, the comments aren't all negative. I mean, people sort of like these virtual meetings. Do you think that in the future, the process of U.S. Wheat will change in terms of having a hybrid of virtual and actual in-person meetings?
Oh, I think very definitely. There was no doubt this was a catalyst. It was one of those things I think our groups and others were kind of working towards, but perhaps didn't feel a huge push to have to do it right now. You know, we could kind of experiment and piecemeal it in. Well, now we're here for you. This is it. If you don't do it now, you're not going to do it at all. So it's been a huge push, and I think it would be totally unlikely that we would imagine you're ever going to return to fully business as usual the way we used to do it. So it's definitely going to be some sort of a hybrid system. But, you know, that just expands the capabilities for us. It allows us to still put people on the ground, put people in offices and bakeries and mills and buying offices to do that. But then in addition to that, also have a whole bunch of material and resources that can be provided, you know, instantaneously and in short bursts. I think one of the things people like about these things is a little bit like what we did last night with Japan. In about an hour's time frame, people can sit in their home or in their kitchen or in their office, doesn't matter, and they can get an hour's worth of updates on everything that might be important to them as far as U.S. wheat in their mix of the business, and then go about their business. They don't have to go anyplace, they don't have to travel, and sit in traffic, buses, planes, trains, anything, and they can get that information in a very short period of time. Now, if I might just comment, I this is just personal outlook on it a little bit. I think there's a little bit of a double edge on these things. And I've noticed it both within domestic meetings we've had, like we had our U.S. Wheat board meeting a couple of weeks ago on a virtual environment, and this some that we've done overseas. When you're not sitting in the same room, when you're not sitting around the table, when you can't see faces, you can't see if people are frowning, are they sleeping, are they excited, are they on the edge of the chair, are they raising their hand, do they have a question? It stifles a little bit the normal cadence of communication that goes on with that. And people either are a little reluctant, they're not familiar with it, they don't want to electronically raise their hand and type a question or intercede with the video or the voice. And so I think we're not really being able to utilize it in quite the same way you would with a group sitting across the table from one another. But maybe that will improve that with time as well, and people will become even more comfortable with it as time goes on.
I attended that virtual meeting that you had at USW's summer board meeting, and that was a meeting in which Darren Padgett, a wheat farmer from Oregon, took over the reins of the organization. How will Padgett's role change as a result of COVID?
Yeah, it's going to be a huge change. And I have to be quite honest, to some degree, I've told Darren this, I almost feel guilty with a new chairman coming in and coming in an environment like this. Because normally at this time of the year, when we had our meeting last a week ago, well, I would have sat down with our chairman and I would have had a calendar of events from July through December of all the places we needed to be around the world, all the events we needed to be at, all the presentations, all the visits to Japan, all the visits to the Philippines, wherever it is we needed to go, would have been all sketched out easily 6 or 8 months in advance. Right now, there is zero on that calendar for the chairman's travel. So that's really sort of a disappointing thing for Darren, particularly if those of the audience that might know Darren, he's a very gregarious, outgoing guy. He's a people person. He's traveled a lot already. He's comfortable doing that, and was really looking forward to it. So it's going to change his way of communicating with customers that he likes to do. Now, that said, last night when we were on the seminar with Japan, there was a huge advantage there with that session. Darren right now is out harvesting in Oregon. He had his iPad and telephone with him on the harvester, and he participated in that meeting, was able to show pictures of the harvest as they were moving, as the trucks were being loaded. He gave his welcome and notes and speech to the group right from the combine. And you know, that has really a kind of a special place and a connection with those buyers that they've never seen before. They have that kind of a close-up look and talk to the chairman of U.S. Wheat while they're actually at there doing their work. So, you know, it'll be an interesting time for Darren. I think he's recognizing that it won't be as travel active. But, you know, the organization still has a lot to do. We've got a lot of things both internally and externally that we're going to do, maybe more on this virtual platform than ever before. And he'll have a role in all of that. So the travel will be the biggest difference for Darren.
Yes, yes. Very disappointing. As you said, Darren is a very engaging individual, and I was looking forward to his chairmanship of U.S. Wheat Associates. One last question, Vince. We talk a lot about quality in the Pacific Northwest, but if you don't count hard white wheat, soft white is the smallest of all classes in the U.S. In other words, we are the tail of the dog, and we can wag all we want, but we can't improve U.S. wheat quality overall. Given that world wheat supplies have continued to be in surplus, Is it time for the U.S. industry to double down on promoting the quality of wheat coming from the U.S.? And can we do that if a large number of farmers continue to brown bag their seed, if country elevators in America's heartland continue to operate on station averages for protein, and if Gulf of Mexico exporters continue to get by without installing cleaners?
Well, you've outlined all the perils that we're dealing with, or the tripwires that are out there in terms of this quality picture that we have. And, you know, and it's become very regional and somewhat class specific factors, as you've sort of outlined. And, you know, there is still in this country a quite a different system that's developed, and it's somewhat market driven. So if you take everything in the PNW and across the northern tier, across the Dakotas, Montana, you know, maybe even all the way to western Minnesota, that group of states, probably down to Colorado and Wyoming, has been exporting to the PNW, where you have a Pacific Rim group of countries that we as U.S. wheat and the industry could work with individually to help them tighten quality specifications, demand quality specifications, and force that back through the system. So there's Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Philippines. You probably got 25-30% of the U.S. wheat exports right there in that group, all with the same exporters or the same destinations. So their incentive was much different than a disparate group of Gulf exporters that range anywhere from, you know, far Texas, Galveston, Houston, all the way to over to the center Texas ports, all the way over to the Mississippi River. When the soft red winter wheat areas are competing with corn and soybeans, just two completely different sort of geographical, environmental, and logistical areas to deal with over here. So you've nailed a whole bunch of things that, in fact, a lot of the hard red winter wheat state organizations are working very hard on. And it's a long road, quite honestly. But it's a road that your premise lays out very well, that the quality of the wheat that we export has got to be at the high end, the premium end, solidly there compared to anything else buyers are going to be looking at. Because if we don't have those quality edges and performance edges, as well as just intrinsic qualities, but we're going to be just relegated to an also-ran sort of circumstance. Right now, if you took that example of Brazil and then the Russian wheat coming over, Russia's done a much better job. I don't take anything away from you. You have to give your competitors credit where and make a fair analysis of it. But right now in Brazil, I would say we can go to them with hard red winter wheat, even as it is and as it's marketed, and probably command several dollars a ton premium over Russian wheat. The reliability of our system, the continuity of the supply, there are many things that the Brazilian millers, the familiarity with the commodity, that the Brazilian millers value in that whole process that builds a little bit of a premium into that. Now, that won't go far. You can't probably sell wheat at $10 premium. They probably won't do that. But that problem to work with the hard red and winter wheat area in particular to get protein premiums transferred to the farmer, frankly, the farmers like to hear this, but to get discounts properly transferred to the farmer. In other words, a lot of times the farmers aren't discounted for dockage. If protein may be station average, dockage may be station average as well. There are just a number of things that need to be done. Now, the issue of, as you said, brown bagging and non-certified seed, boy, that's going to be I'm not sure if we solve that very, very quickly. So I think the grain handling, the marketing system is going to have to come along first in order to do that. So you've laid out the challenges for us. We have a joint U.S. and NOG Wheat Quality Committee that deals with these things. They meet quite frequently. We have state meetings about them. The will and the effort is there, but the road is long, and it's been a long road we've been on, but I think we have to stay on it because it's really the future of our business.
Quality is the future of our business, and it's not just the Washington Grain Commission saying it. As you heard, the president of U.S. Wheat Associates makes no bones that quality is the direction we've all got to head as an industry. Because while wheat is not particularly difficult to grow, quality wheat requires more effort, and not just on the farm. Every link along the grain chain has to buy into quality, from breeder to farmer to elevator to exporter to vessel to customer. There's no doubt that wheat farmers in the Pacific Northwest have gotten that message. Our Asian soft white wheat market began demanding quality about 20 years ago. Now they expect it. Yes, yield pays the bills, but you've got to have countries willing to take those bushels, and as you heard Peterson say, even as wheat consumption has increased, production has increased faster. Quality is not the question. Quality is the answer. I hope you've enjoyed this two-part conversation with the president of U.S. Wheat Associates in episodes I entitled, So How'd We Do? USW's Vince Peterson assesses trade agreements, wheat exports, prices, COVID-19, virtual meetings, and more. Right here on Wheat All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil and fill our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.